You can get pretty far in life in terms of years without fully coming to grips with how you got to be who you are. Patterns and approaches we adopted as kids can certainly stick around long after they've outlived their usefulness to us as adults. We can change our old stories, replacing the child's view with an adult's view. This is the approach advocated by our next guest, Rosamund Stone Zander, in her book Pathways to Possibility, Transforming Our Relationship with Ourselves, Each Other, and the World. Rosamund Stone Zander is a family systems therapist. Much of her work focuses on coaching organizations from the inside out, organizations like schools, hospitals, and corporations. She and Benjamin Zander wrote a previous book called The Art of Possibility. Rosamund, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. That's great pleasure.
It sounds like the earlier book exceeded your expectations. Tell us about the reception for it.
I remember writing that book and thinking, oh, you know, nobody's going to want to read it. And now it's got over 600,000 copies in people's hands and 17 languages. So it's amazing.
So was Pathways to Possibility the logical follow-up to that book?
Well, it's not a logical follow-up. There have been almost 16 years between the two books. When I wrote The Art of Possibility, I thought I'd sort of, egoistically, I thought I'd covered the waterfront. But I realized after a few bumps in the road that there was lots more to say. And so this book takes it much more deeply into the personal and further out, actually, into a broader world. So.
And there are two approaches that you talked about in your work, the downward spiral versus radiating possibility. Can you lay out the differences there?
Yeah, sure. We're born into a way of looking at the world, which is really meant to help us survive. I'm saying nature does this for us so that as children and growing older, we protect ourselves. We think of ourselves as number one. It's everything is personal, and we get into fights because we decide that something is right and somebody else is wrong. It's kind of black and white. And then after a while, if you keep up this way of thinking, we call that the downward spiral. It's based in survival. Things get harder and heavier, and we kind of go downhill, even though, I mean, you can look at older people and they're kind of bent over with the burden of it all. Even though there are great highs and joys and winning and losing in the downward spiral. That's one way of looking at life. Then we have another invented way, which is called possibility, which is based in the idea that life is really a story you're telling yourself. And there is no real access to reality in that sense. You live in a story that's given to you by being human, but also mostly by the cultures you live in and the family you grow up in and the things that happen to you as a child. And when you understand that that's a story, not reality, you have an enormous ability to rise above it and start changing things. And so, so possibility. The framework of possibility is all about creativity, about redoing stories, and it's really about leadership. Because if you know you can bring to pass in collaboration with others everything, almost everything you dream of. It might be a long time frame. You naturally step into leadership.
So as I perused the table of contents before getting into the book itself, my eyes fell on chapter 11, where the word advice is crossed out. Isn't this book about advice, though?
No, I hope it isn't. The advice is crossed out because when people give advice to others, they're coming out of their story, trying to put it onto the other person. Now, if you have good advice, your story is probably better than the person you're advising. But it's still a kind of a force that you're applying. And if you don't realize that what you're doing is trying to substitute your story for theirs, you can get into a lot of trouble. It's just that people will resist your advice, and then you'll try harder, and then you'll get into discordant relationships with them.
It sounds like a really important thing for people to remember, though, is that what works for you is not what works for necessarily for anybody else.
Exactly so.
All right, the first story in the book, Rosamund, is about you realizing that you were feeling things your mother had talked about. So how much of each of us is a real composite of the people around us as we grew?
Well, I think a great deal of each of us is a composite. And, of course, again, it's awareness that will help you with that. We come in parts. And some of our feelings come from memories of our growing up and our parents and what they had to say, and some of them come from other things. Some are our own inventions as we grow older. So yes, we're made up of many parts, and we think we're an integrated whole. And so it's always very concerning to us if we find ourselves doing something that we didn't mean to do because some part of us is having their day.
Well, to be even more pointed, I mean, how much do we tend to throw things onto, well, that's me, or that's the way I am, when we could be somewhat choosier about deciding that?
Well, that's because we don't realize that we can be choosier, and then we get very stuck in positions saying, no, I don't listen to criticism. That's just not who I am. I don't. Well, that's too bad. It's not who you are. It's the story you're telling yourself. Or I'm afraid of dogs or water, or I don't venture out. That's just who I am. No, it's not.
Huh. So people who say things like I'm not a joiner or I don't make friends easily or all that, I mean, they could change that story.
They could definitely change that story.
All right. Changing stories is a lot of what this book is about. It is called Pathways to Possibility, Transforming Our Relationship with Ourselves, Each Other, and the World. Rosamund Stone Zander is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Rosamund and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinling. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is family systems therapist Rosamund Stone Zander, the author of Pathways to Possibility, Transforming Our Relationships with Ourselves, Each Other, and the World. In essence, changing our stories, not necessarily taking what we believed about ourselves to be true and the stories about how we got here and putting our new perspective, our current adult perspective upon those. You can join us on The Exchange as we talk about the issue and how to go about some effort to change ourselves. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it seems, Rosamund, like we're forced to confront the issue of maturity here, that, you know, if we're going to apply adult perspectives to the stories of our childhood, that we need to think in terms of maturity. I'm still waiting. What is maturity to you?
Well, maturity to me, I would say, is really the power of unencumbered love, the ability to have an open-hearted relationship with anybody on earth. Now, most of us think we can do that with a few people, but certainly, you know, not with everybody and all the differences. So I would say that is what I call being truly adult, is having the capacity and knowing it, and then you have to exercise some effort in it, of being of the power of unencumbered love, open, embracing love.
Well, and as you point out, we get here because people rub off on you, which it's a great phrase, great way to think about it. So it seems like a part of maturity then would be saying we will not follow our parents' patterns.
Well, some of our parents' patterns are perfectly wonderful and fit for the world today. The trouble is the patterns that we come up with, and often from our child mind when we're children, taking stuff from our parents, those are not necessarily apt for the world we're living in today. So you're living in the past, not the present. And, of course, that takes away so much power. I have to say, Jeff, I'm really impressed by how well you've read this book.
Oh, thank you. I figured it would be a good way to talk to you about it. Let's get further into the book then, because there are some people you follow all through it. The great story of Alan in the first chapter. Tell us about how he incorporated his parents' ways into his adult life.
The patterns go way back into his ancestry. Alan was a three-year-old child whose parents had divorced, and the story goes that the father was coming home for Christmas. He's visiting the home for Christmas. Alan lived with his mother and his sister. And his mother whispered to him just before Christmas Day, "You're not going to like the present Daddy is going to give you." And, of course, that is a very subversive whisper, because it meant for Alan that he wasn't supposed to like the present that Daddy was giving him. It was clear to him that his parents were not getting along and that he was supposed to follow what his mother wanted when she was whispering that. Then he found that, in fact, he loved the present his father gave him, which was a glass music box so you could see inside. And he also loved the present that his mother gave him, which was a bear, a stuffed bear, like the one his father gave his sister. So he was torn. He didn't know how to hold the love for his father and his mother in his heart. And since he couldn't imagine, as you can when you're an adult, that these parents are going through different sorts of experiences, and it's all about them, not about him, he had to come up with a story that would save him, that would keep him safe and secure. And the story he came up with was, if I love in secret, you see the bear and the music box are under the covers with him, if I love in secret, I can have both a mother and a father, if I never say anything about it, if I divide myself in that way. It turns out that his parents had been divided in that way. His father had had affairs, and his mother was in grief and trying to hold on to things as she was holding on to her son. So he incorporated those long trends into his new story, which is Love in Secret. And that story then set the path for him for life to come. He found himself making very close, intimate relationships which didn't cross over. Close relationships with teachers, one-on-one. He became a lawyer, and he had privileged conversations. Of course, he was completely unaware of this. And then he found himself having affairs himself, following the pattern of his father, which he did not consciously know. And he told himself that that's what he had to do, and he had all sorts of rationales, because our brains come up with absolute airtight rationales for things that try to cover what our emotional life, the unresolved emotional life. So he said, you know, fidelity is not really built into being a human being, and it's sophisticated to have affairs. But in fact, he was acting like an emotional three-year-old and not growing any further, because the safety pattern of loving in secret kept him from being honest and open with anybody, really. And what happened eventually was that his wife took off and had an affair with somebody else, and he was having, and the relationship he had going on the side was, the woman was appalled that he would mourn the wife that she'd heard a different story about. So she left too, and he had a major trauma in his 50s.
We're talking to Rosamund Stone Zander here in the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Pathways to Possibility. So this idea of a secret love, though, I mean, he loved the teddy bear secretly. I loved the music box secretly, whichever, led him to this dual track life where he was going to love people separately from one another.
That's right. And so that he could entertain loves that were incompatible because he was doing it separately. But he was unable to see the pattern, as most of us can't see our patterns. He wasn't able to label it as something that he should work on. And the reason is because his life was in balance. And what we do with our stories as we grow older is try to get a life of equilibrium so everything works. And it worked, but it didn't work to allow him to grow and flourish and really have an intimate relationship. So when his wife left him, he was absolutely devastated. But in a certain sense, it was the best thing that could have happened to him, because when you have a trauma like that, your brain is open to change, which it isn't otherwise. And not that anybody wants that kind of thing to happen, but it really is the best thing for change.
It certainly disrupts the standard line of things going on. And in fact, you talk about safety patterns in here. What is a safety pattern?
Well, safety pattern is a story or a pattern of behavior that a child devises, like love in secret, that makes you feel as though you've got an answer to a problem that you can't, as a child, resolve. An answer to something that's fearful or something where you think you're going to fail. And so once you come up with a story that covers it, we call that a safety pattern. It might be love in secret, but it might also be give yourself over entirely to what others need, or remain strong at all costs. These things, which of course is fine for that child, but is not. It's fine. It was fine for that time that the child was living with those people, but be strong at all costs is not a pattern that will serve you through your life, or give yourself over entirely to other people will not be useful to you later on. So we call those safety patterns because they're coming from the desire to remain safe as a child.
Rosamund Stone Zander, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a family systems therapist. Her book is Pathways to Possibility, Transforming Our Relationship with Ourselves, Each Other, and the World. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the Exchange with stories of your own to tell, if you choose, or questions to ask. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So this idea of changing stories, which is the central point of the book, I'd say, where you're taking the stories that you told yourself as a kid and using your adult mind on that. As you point out, this is more than just a metaphorical mapping of a way out of trauma. I mean, you're doing something to the brain here. What is that?
Yeah, the fears and the triggers that we feel that make us suddenly angry and so on, they're pathways in the brain, and they get activated when the similar circumstance occurs that was there when you made up the story. So if we take Alan, whenever anybody tried to argue with him that he cared about, or a boss looked askance at him, he would revert to the safety pattern. And those are neural pathways in the brain, and they get activated, and he sees things then as, oh, I can't argue with this person, I just have to have another person in the wings.
One of the real, as you talk about rewriting stories, one of the real key phrases here is peel your memories off of others, which sounds very powerful. Explain how that works.
Well, I actually really experience that. What happens is that when you, let's say you're worried that somebody is rejecting you. Now, you're building a story about somebody rejecting you that he or she may be, although I don't think anything in an adult life can be considered personal like that. However, I'm not commenting on what the other person is doing. I'm saying, let's say I have an idea that I'm being rejected. Well, that's a very that's a story that isn't going to take me very far, except it's going to make me nervous and tongue-tied and try to either get affection or stay away. What I want people to do is to say at that point, this is a memory of a feeling state way back in childhood. Any kind of feeling of rejection is going to be a memory of an early feeling state, because all children go through rejection experiences, and we ought to outgrow them, but we don't, because they get the pathways get reinforced as in similar situations as we get older. So if we can say it's a memory, and let me peel it off this person who's standing in front of me, and see this person devoid of that memory of rejection, which is in me, not being done to me, then you can suddenly see that the poor person has had this burden of being thought to be a rejecter put upon him. And it can be very, very clarifying.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're taking so much of the emotional weight off of the memory, at least where it connects with the person in the present day. You're not,
exactly.
You're no longer blaming your wife for the things your mother did, for example.
Exactly. You take the emotional weight off the person standing in front of you, and you realize you've had these emotional feelings, but they're not here. They aren't appropriate now, and so they drop away, too, from your own body.
Rosamund Stone Zander, again, our guest on The Exchange. Her book is called Pathways to Possibility. Another phrase in here that comes ringing through, what you resist persists, which it seems like heard variations of before, but essentially the harder you try to avoid being something, the easier you make for it to happen, don't you?
That's the case. For one thing, what you're avoiding, when you avoid something, let's give an example of that. Do you have an example, Charles?
You know, you decide you're not going to be an angry, thundering person, and in the process of denying that you ever act like that, you end up acting like it.
Right. And that's because you haven't really let go of the anger and the thunder. You're just trying to hold it in, and you build up energy around that, and then out it comes. It's the perfect story of Oedipus, of course.
True. I hadn't thought about that part of it. In another case study in Pathways to Possibility, you write of a woman blocked from following her goals and dreams in life as trauma, which raises the question, having talked to a guest recently about a trauma-informed culture, have we broadened the definition of trauma?
Say a little more about that.
Well, if we're always assuming that the things that happen to people, I mean, the adverse things in your life that redirect you, I mean, are they necessarily labeled trauma? Are we over-defining trauma?
Well, only use the word trauma if it's useful. If you live in a world, if you live in the point of view that life is a story you're telling, don't tell yourself stories that aren't going to be helpful to you. So the trouble with what we do ordinarily is we say, is this trauma or isn't it? Are we overusing it? Well, if we are, just drop it. I think it can be useful if you talk about trauma. If it's useful for you to say, I was stopped emotionally by an incident, maybe you can remember it or you can get the age of it. I know I was stopped there, and I thought I should never step forward again. I shouldn't be aggressive or just outgoing. Bad things are going to happen. If you know that you've had that block, and I can call that a mini trauma, I'm happy to do that. But if it means something different to you, don't call it that. It's useful to just be able to say, okay, I get that, but that was when I was 4. And of course I was stopped then. I don't need to be stopped now. It says nothing about the world that I was stopped when I was 4.
So among the practices that you advocate here, you say call yourself a field of awareness. What does that mean?
Well, it means it's a device. A lot of what I do in this book is to create devices that help you to move out of the tight space that you're living in. So call yourself a field of awareness simply means think of yourself as aware of everything, or potentially aware of everything, and then look at yourself as a character in your own field of awareness. Look at yourself as you walk through life as somebody in your field of awareness. So now I am not myself walking through life, but I am a field of awareness looking at myself walking through life. And that gives you a perspective and freedom from the things that grip you as you walk through life.
This really is a dropping, or at least a momentary sensation of cessation of judgment, it sounds like, both of other people and of yourself.
Oh, definitely. I'm glad you picked that up, because if you do these practices, you really don't judge anymore. Now, that doesn't mean you can't measure in some way or other, but you don't get stuck judging people and being unable to relate to them. That's what I mean when I say unencumbered love. The wholeheartedness, the ability to open your arms to the person who you think has betrayed you or done you wrong, and drop all that and see them as a human being. That is really the direction I want people to move in.
All right, more from Rosamund Stone Zander and Pathways to Possibility in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest today is Rosamund Stone Zander. She's a family systems therapist, working with individuals and coaching organizations as well. The book she's written is called Pathways to Possibility, Transforming Our Relationship with Ourselves, Each Other, and the World. It is largely about rewriting our stories, the stories of what shaped us when we were kids. We can rewrite those stories with the adult perspective we now possess. You can talk about this with us on The Exchange. Questions, comments, stories, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked about how individuals work on their stories, Rosamund. Alan in particular is the example we first gave here. How about in couples? I mean, do couples have to rewrite their stories with each other, or the individual ones from their own formative years?
Well, the ones they want, the couples will want to rewrite are the ones that are getting stuck between them. I mean, you might want to just rewrite everything you can see, but between couples, often what happens is that all the desires and ideal notions of what a partner could be are how the relationship starts. And with that, with a wonderful endorphins flowing through your body, you find everything ideal. And then after a while, what you find is that you're coming up against what you used to like, you suddenly don't like so much anymore. And that's the point in which it would be a good idea for couples to decide to clear their own child stories before they actually decide to leave each other. Or it would be wonderful even if they did it before they got married, but that's probably not likely. Because marriage or being together is a perfect milieu for finding your own child stories. You get feeling hurt, you get righteous about things. You know what the other person is like, because in the child mind, there's no flexibility of seeing a person as in a multiple and many-faceted way. There's no flexibility there. You know what he's like. He's lazy, or he's not affectionate, or whatever else, and she is going to undermine me for the rest of my life, that kind of thing. Those are all child points of view, and there's a lot of survival feeling of I've got to get out of this, or I've got to change this person. I'll never survive if I don't. And those are the moments to look to yourself and the stories that you started as a younger person. I say, as one of the practices, never argue with the child part of your partner.
Only the adult
part. You won't get anywhere. And what it will do is it'll trigger the child part in you. And you know what happens when children get fighting. Somebody's going to get hurt.
So are we talking about a literal rewriting of our own stories here? I mean, do you advocate that people sit down and put the tale on paper, on computer screen, on whatever? And
yes, then, I think I do.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it in a broader way, but if you can get to the literal rewriting, it's really good. I have a story in the book which is about a writer's block, and I was going every weekend to a cabin to write The Art of Possibility, the previous book, and I just got stuck. And in ways that I think everybody will be familiar with, I kept going to the refrigerator or taking the dog for a walk, and I never got really down to, quote, writing, and it made me extremely frustrated and very frightened. So by the third weekend of doing this, I said, I think I have to rewrite a story here. I mean, it took me a while to recognize that what I was writing about was what I should be doing. So I looked to see what the story I had going was on this, and it turned out that the story was that writing is sitting at a computer and putting words on the screen. And I thought, if I rewrote that story, it could maybe something could loosen up here. And I did manage to think more broadly. And I always say, enlarge the frame. If it's too narrow a definition, you're probably in a child or in trouble.
Mm-hmm. In the circumstance you're talking about, though, with the writing weekends, is this when you realized you were doing the things your mother might have done?
No, that was the beginning of the book, when I was feeling. Let me just tell you the end of rewriting the story about writer's block.
Sure.
I said then that writing, everything I do at this cabin over the 3-day weekend, everything I do is writing. So taking walks is writing, going to the refrigerator, having meals, napping, all that is writing. And it made perfect sense to me when I saw it, because you need a very broad perspective to write about possibility, to find out what you really have to say. And once I accepted that story, which I was able to do, I never had trouble again, because everything I was doing was writing when I was at that cabin.
I see. So you broadened the definition way far beyond just sitting at the computer and typing words onto the screen.
That's right.
Okay.
It was very effective. And so you were asking me about the stories of when in the beginning I was saying that I was feeling a kind of melancholy, which I realized was not really mine, but which belonged to my mother. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I used my thinking brain to realize that it wasn't, that emotion didn't really start with me. It was something she had felt in the same landscape that I was feeling it. And she'd had lots of difficulties, and her difficulties frightened me a little bit, but they did not come, my difficulties didn't come from the landscape where I was feeling these things. So as soon as I said, oh, these are my mother's feelings, not mine, everything brightened up. So making distinctions is really useful in changing the patterns and changing the beliefs you have.
Okay, Rosamund, we have a set of questions actually from Leslie in Ashland, who wants to know about your organizational work, and she wants to know, how do you engage organizations in this kind of work? It seems that many, perhaps most organizations, veer away from emotions and personal work. I fully affirm that much of the dysfunction stems from old childhood patterns playing out in the hierarchical structures. Would you give some examples of how you got started and kept on working with organizations of different types? That again from Leslie in Ashland.
Okay. Thanks for the question. I have worked with several leadership teams. One was particularly interesting to me because it was a team in a diamond mining company in South Africa in which there were 7 people on the leadership team. I also worked with Whirlpool that way and other companies. But these 7 people were willing. They came from all walks of life, and they'd been through the apartheid movement, so they all had reason to have differences. They were all different colors as well, and they had reason to have difficulties, but they also had reason. They had a lot of energy behind solving the problems. And for some reason, when I begin talking to people about stories they had as children in a group, I don't get much resistance to it.
Hmm.
People want to talk. People want to be known in different ways. And it is almost always very enlightening for them and very gratifying for people to do this. And it brings a group together enormously well. Mm. I think there was another part to that question that I forgot.
She just wanted some examples of how you got started and kept on working with organizations of different types. I mean, basically how you engage the organizations. And it sounds like it's a lot easier than we might have thought.
I think it's a lot easier. Also, a lot of the organizations that I worked with started with the book, The Art of Possibility, which has practices in it that got them very, very interested. Giving an A. They tried to embed these in the organizations and had a little difficulty at first because they were looking at things from the ordinary way of looking at things instead of that life is a creation. But once they got that, lots of things could happen. They could give an A to employees and not measure them,
mm-hmm.
double negative. And we have another practice was leading from any chair. That's a fantastic practice. If people understand that they can change an organization from any point in the system, it might take a little longer than if you were the CEO, but you can do it, and you can do it by starting a conversation for possibility, mm-hmm. and being strategic about it, and you can change things.
As you point out, some of the organizations you work with call themselves families. Is that healthy, and do many organizations end up replicating the dynamics of family, especially the bad parts?
Well, that's a well-understood thing from you, Jeff. Yes, I can think of a lot of organizations that have credos and value statements that talk about family. But if you find jealousies in an organization and they're talking about family, you know they're talking about a hierarchically arranged family where, of course, there's sibling rivalry and there is a sense that the father as boss is going to be harsh in one sense or another. You have to be worried about it. That's not the kind of family that works well for organizations In this day and age, moving forward, it has worked well, but the way the world is moving now, it's not the best form. So, if people are willing to transform themselves within an organization, they can use whatever term they want, but there is a kind of family that we would say is regressive, and that's what many, many organizations fall into.
Jim and Eugene asks, when people follow their parents' footsteps in regards to career, does that mean they're living their parents' stories?
Well, first of all, it's not bad to be living your parents' stories if the parents' story is a flexible and creative story, or even a story that just worked well for your parents. If you follow in the footsteps, as in the role the parents took, it doesn't mean you get caught in that. So no, it does not mean that you're following a child's story by following your parents' profession. In fact, you may be. It may be the best thing in the world for you because you have all that know-how behind you, and so you're growing. You're growing your parents. You're growing yourself beyond that. But of course, if you get stuck in the child dynamics, then it's maybe even harder for you if you're in the same career that your parents had.
As we talk about changing our stories, if, for example, you're looking at something that might have happened in high school or college and you think, boy, I'd really like to think about that story differently, I mean, does it necessarily always trace back to another story in childhood? I mean, generally, in the formative years, is that what everything's going to come back to?
No. In a sense, it is, because the story that you have going as an adolescent, let's say, if it's kind of skewed the way, let's say, Alan was when he got to be an adolescent, he wouldn't know he was living out of a child story. That is, the person who had a safety pattern that said love in secret, he wouldn't have known that. And he might have had some other thing happen to him in the adolescence that made him sit up and take notice. You can change that story anywhere along the line. But the only thing to look for is, does it have the elements of a child story, or does it have the elements of an adult story, which is you're not the center of the universe in an adult story. You have a flexible mind. You have an ability to be in other people's shoes. You don't take things personally, and you. I'm trying to think what other aspects, but there are plenty. But that's quite opposite to the child for whom everything is about him, everything is taken personally, everything is about being right.
There's certainly a lot to learn in the book, and in fact, there's one chapter called Can We Change People? Yes, we can, which is probably the whole point that Rosamund Stone Zander had in writing it. The book is called Pathways to Possibility. Rosamund, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it enormously.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay.